Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Low and roll face Jackson Jackson. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 28. Piling on a rally from yesterday. NASDAQ Futures up 188. Got oil down a little bit. We need about 8 more weeks of maybe there'll be a problem with the solution to the war, and then maybe 6 more weeks of actual war, and then 8 more weeks of a problem. God, we'll get this market up to astronomical heights. It's a plan. What do you think, Kevin?
I doubt it's a plan, but sure.
You know what? It sure as hell shouldn't be a plan, but I've seen... Every time I've seen a crisis like this here and in other countries in the last 30 years, you put money in and you reward the rich people. It's just like the Mexicans devaluing their currency after telling all the inside people they were going to do it 40 years ago. It's the same crap.
I see where you're going with it, but why? What makes you think dragging this out is in any way politically beneficial to Trump?
Oh, I'm not. I'm not that to him. No, God, no. But I'm saying in terms of pouring more money into the system and having certain people having their fixed investments, meaning mostly all stock markets now and houses, go straight up. I mean, a lot of people would cheer that. I mean, nobody wanted COVID to go any longer. But when the market was at record highs coming out of COVID after essentially a depression for 2 years.
Was that because of COVID, or was that because of the amount of money that was poured into the system during
nonsense? As your buddy Rahm Emanuel once said, don't ever waste a good crisis.
Yeah, okay. And from a controlling standpoint, they didn't. And in many ways, it seemed like COVID was a test run for seeing what they could, what could be imposed on the public, and what the public would accept in the name of emergency. But other than that, I don't think that COVID itself was what sprung the market, unless you are talking about the market for pharmaceutical stocks. But on the other hand, you would be. It was really a function of the amount of money that got pumped into the system.
Well, that's right.
Wasn't it?
And every time there's a crisis, that's the excuse. We don't even look at our stuff. We don't even look at Trump. I mean, you would think that everybody who talks about Japan, when John Lee was on a couple of weeks ago, the inflation for everyday Japanese person is not even like what's published, sort of like here. And all you care about is that, they're a serious ally of ours, and they're paying through the nose for the oil, and they're paying through the nose for the currency's going down. But you look up and you go, wait a minute. Didn't their market just reach a record high yesterday? And all the banks that were zombie banks for 30 years and are now fatter and happier than they've ever been? I mean, it's the coincidence is just bizarre. you don't even have to look here. It's not even about it. Somehow people who are sort of in charge use all these little crises to distance themselves from the rest of the people all the time. It's not just us. I mean, it's... It seems to be everybody. And when are people going to get wise to it, I guess, is my question.
And I guess there's a certain amount of chicken and egg argument in there, is that people taking advantage of the the supposed crisis, or is the crisis being made so that people can take advantage of it?
I'm not going to go that far. I'm not going to say we started this war so we could put money in the system. I'm not going to go there. But once it happens, people are going to go, hey, wait a minute, this is kind of cool. I mean, right? I mean, for us, I mean, it's a... I don't know, I'm just saying, this is how many times now we did it with Vietnam, right? I mean, this is not new. Let's pour money in the system to allegedly pay for the Vietnam War, but what did that do? Actually, in those days, the interest rates ran up so much, the Fed didn't fight the long-term rate, so it really didn't help the market. It went the other way. But we've never made that mistake again. Now we make sure we buy up the long-term stuff to the point where you're not going to get the interest rates that people got back in those days. I mean, your mom was getting 15% at the local savings and loan. What are you getting now? 2?
Yeah. And paying 17 if you wanted to buy a house.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, what was the housing? Those were the best buys ever. Right? Because the price...
If you could, especially if you had the capital to do it, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the prices were... God, I bought my place in Beverly for, what, $125 or something? 2 lots? I mean, it was the best... I mean, and the rates went down, but your price stayed the same, right? I mean, your price did nothing but go up. Everybody talks about the best time to buy houses is when rates are down. How is it that people have a third-grade economic... education, for God's sake. Best time to buy a house is when rates are high and the house price is down, because the rates can come down. You can refinance and you still got the low price, right?
Yep.
What about?
Well, I lived in Milwaukee for a little over 5 years, almost 6 years. Bought a house after the first year, and I think I refinanced it twice, because yeah. that was the big. You know, the big short times.
Well, as they say, timing is everything. One of the guys on the show lives out in Glen Allen. He's lived in his house, got it around 20-some years now. When he bought his place, it was one, I forget when the hell it actually was, but interest rates were pretty high. And he got an adjustable loan. And everybody goes, oh, man. Last thing he wanted is an adjustable loan. I think in 10 years, Kevin, every year the thing went down. Well, now it's probably started going back up if he hasn't paid it off, but... He's like, what are you talking about? Every year the thing goes down. It's the greatest deal I ever made. Timing is everything, right?
Oh, yeah, it is. And, yeah, if rates are high, and adjustable is a good thing because you're going to adjust down.
What do you make of individual stocks in the market, like this Micron being up 250 points now in like 200 points in like 2 days? What other than momentum trading, for those that don't know, momentum trading, it's kind of always been there, but now you're buying it because it's going up, because you're jamming people to be short, and it develops momentum on its own. We're talking about a stock that was up like 20% yesterday, and now it's up 8% today. I mean, let me get a chart of this thing. Their revenue per share is $51, so we're pushing $20, 20 times revenue, and probably 50 times earnings. And we're not talking about a massive growth stock, unless there's something here. I mean, when I say that, it's been around a while. I mean, it might have some new stuff. But there's a little dip here, so it's a tad unfair. But April 1st, the stock was 367. Now it's 968. Now, unless, and I haven't heard, but unless this is one of those we're going to hear today that, you know, the administration took a piece of them or something, they're going to be, whatever they do is going to be the prime supplier to the government or something, which you do have to be worried about today. Well, not worried about it. If you own the stock, you hope it happens, obviously. But Kevin, we're talking about there's a billion one three shares outstanding. So in the last two days, this thing is up $260 billion in market cap. You know, if you're a Chief Kevin Enterprises, and we got some little firm, and all of a sudden, you know, you kick the stove like in the Lone Ranger, and you find a silver mine underneath it. I guess that could happen, you know. And some people do have innovations and all kinds of things, but it's pretty rare for a company that's been around as long as these guys. And by the way, these guys were like the poster child of going to the moon and crashing in 2001. Are they going to do the same thing? 26? I hope not. Are they going to do the same thing? 20? How can the same stock do the same thing? You would think people would have some kind of a memory, but maybe they don't. I don't know. I mean, it went from 190-something to 6 in 2001, which is the equivalent of this being 965 to like 100 now. I mean, I sure as hell hope that doesn't happen. But what do you make of? But to try
In the case of Micron, I really don't. I don't have an opinion specifically on it because I really haven't looked into what's going on with the company. So, I don't have a lot to offer on the specific stock. But I do think, you're right identifying all of the wild swings that go on in individual stocks. You know, I think that's let me put it this way, that even on the best of news, unless somebody has, come up with the cure for cancer or something like that, I don't know what can make it move like that either direction. I don't know what, unless we discover, some fatal flaw in somebody's books or something, crazy like that. I don't know what can make it knock down similarly. So, I would have to know. I would have to know personally more about the individual stock than I would about the to offer an opinion on that.
Well, me too. I don't know that much about them, but it seems like you're talking about a major shift in their ability to all of a sudden make money like this week. And if it was that kind of a thing, if it was some that kind of an invention or that kind of a discovery, you would think it would be obvious to everybody, right? I mean, they'd say, "Oh, we just struck gold."
It would be all over the news. Yes.
Yeah. But to tie it into what Hal's been talking about, let's just say 300 points. All right, so that's $330 billion in people's. I guess there's some people that might have the certificate at home, but not too many. $330 billion in people's brokerage accounts at Merrill Lynch. I'm sure we have some people here that have it. Kevin, those people can go out today and borrow another $330 billion. Because now you have equity of $330, which you didn't have 2 weeks ago. So there's roughly $60 billion of buying power now available for the market. What do you think would happen? How many people would have to try and go out and get a remodeling, plumbers, electrician, you name it, loan to equal $660 billion?
Depends on how bad a shape your house is in, I guess.
I guess so. How many
people? Ask John Flanagan. He'll know.
Is he here? Is he on? Hey, John.
Good morning, all.
Kevin, I invited John on because he got skunked on Memorial Day. We didn't have a show.
I'm delighted he's here. It's always good to chat with John, and I don't get to do it often enough. So well,
thank you, Kevin. Same here.
Well, he doesn't come out very much.
It's not like I'm out in Chicago with you all the time.
No, that's true, too. What, by the way, your reunion is this weekend, right?
It is next weekend.
Next weekend.
Next week, starting Thursday, is my 50th year reunion.
What is the?
You guys come over and hang out, maybe on Saturday or something, on Friday.
Where's everybody staying? Is there staying in the same place we stayed 2 years ago in that hotel across the street?
I'm staying at my house. My roommate is staying at a place in Mishawaka, and I don't know where everybody else is staying.
Well, my year they suggested the place.
Remember, a lot of the guys that I've lost several of the guys that I've that
true.
I used to hang
yeah.
around with. So
yeah, that's true.
There's
yeah.
a lot of people I'm very much looking forward to seeing, but my closest friends from my class, there's only a few of us left.
Well, the reason why I asked,
you guys, hanging around with you guys was really hard on us.
Well, yeah. So, God, they shoved us. This is a little bit of a talk about the place not being yours anymore. The deal, when you made it to your 50th year, you used to stay in the Morris Inn, which is the hotel on campus. Well, they remodeled the Morris Inn, and it's too much of a one-percenter place, so it's too expensive to put schlumps like us in it. So they kind of shoved us. Every other year, you stay in a dorm. Well, then they decided that the old people couldn't stay in a dorm. It was unsafe. So they
plus they built some hotels across the street.
Right.
So it's part of the development near campus, so...
Well, what they said was
fairly recently.
I see you didn't get the letter, obviously. The letter was they got rid of the army cots, which were in the dorm rooms for 80 years. They got rid of the army cots and went with these new style bed, which evidently has the storage under the bed. I don't know if you remember his letter, Jen. And they said they didn't think people, 50th year people, since the bed is now, what was it, 32 inches off the ground or 33 inches off the ground, they thought it would be unsafe. So maybe we all should stay in a hotel across the street, which, by the way, everybody did, which was actually pretty nice because they have a brunch and they had a big party Friday night for that class in the place with a guy doing records and stuff.
People like me who just crashed it because we were hanging out with
people.
Yeah,
but it actually turned out to be really nice. And the reason why I asked was the best spot there was brunch the next morning because everybody came down to brunch. So I just went down there early. I got to talk to your brother for an hour and other people for an hour. That's right. So my reason why I asked was if everybody was going to stay there, I was going to see if John wanted to scoot down early Saturday morning and just hang with people there at the brunch.
Well, if not, you do have a classmate of yours or two. Just to fill in the blank for listeners, once you reunions like. You know, like everybody knows, your high school reunion, your college reunions, all that, they pretty much have them every 5 years. But once you hit your 50th year reunion, then you're invited every year. I'm guessing they're figuring because you might not see the next 5 years at your age.
Well, you're supposed to have made a lot of money, too. And they have all kinds of things about how giving money to the university is like...
something to donate, yes. So you guys will have a classmate or two who are going to be up there over the weekend as well. If you guys want me to set up something for Saturday morning, even if it's not, not at the hotel there, I could do that easily.
Well, we'll consider. Do they? If you give money when you're about ready to croak, is that an indulgence? Can you get something back for that?
There was a time.
if anybody doesn't know what an indulgence. Is in the Middle Ages they would, I mean, if you died and you weren't quite ready for heaven, you had to spend time in purgatory. If anybody remembers any of this stuff, well,
before it was a ski resort,
before it was a ski resort. So the idea was you could buy time off in purgatory, sort of like buying yourself a pardon today, sort of the same sort of deal. But now my question always was. But what was it, Jen? The plenary indulgence got you off of all your time,
right?
But if you went,
it's certain novenas or cycles that you would perform. You know, they would say this is a 10 years indulgence, which in times of eternity, 10 years is a whole lot of time to get it knocked off of your sentence. But it was very carefully calibrated and coordinated for various liturgies and so on that you would perform, and the plenary was like you get out of jail free card. It was just.
Well, what if he stole a baseball from a kid the next day? Did it go onward for life? Or?
Again. You just started the meter running again.
It wasn't like Hunter Biden's pardon for everything he hasn't done yet, too.
Oh, let's not get into the pardons, but God, we could go a long way with there. But so, Jan, we're talking about some of these runaway stock prices and how, without even looking at our stuff, the idea that Japan. Market is making new highs is astounding to me, considering the alleged hurt that the oil prices and everything have done to Japan's economy. Yet we really are in a two different worlds, as Larissa always talks about the K-shaped economy. Although I don't know if you guys remember last week, she said something about, and would love you guys to comment on it. She said that the top part of the K. is getting smaller and smaller. That some of the bottom K people are starting to tumble into the bottom into the part not doing so hot. Do you guys hear that?
I didn't, because if you remember last week I had to jump off for a meeting, so I usually try to go back and listen to what I missed, but in that case I didn't. So, but. That may be. We'll have to see. I think the one, when we go back and we say, is this in Trump's interest politically? And the answer being, no, it's not, because he needs specifically gas prices, but he needs good economic news going into the midterms. And of course, gas, you know, gas prices are always the big pain point, because, you know, it's up on a big sign on four corners every intersection you go to, so it just gets waved in front of people. You know, to me, the big thing is diesel, and it was good to see, you know, the last couple of days diesel's down about 20-30 cents here, because that's the one that gets baked into the cost side of the equation for a lot of industries, and that, you know, that makes it difficult in a lot of ways. If they can pass on the cost, you're going to have to, you'll feel it on your grocery bills and such. But most industries can't just pass on the cost, at least not 100%. So it affects, you know, things like employment. It creates economic slowdown and limits the hours that people work, all kinds of things like that that come into play. So, you know, to me, the more important indicator in terms of the economic direction is the diesel costs rather than the cost of a gallon of regular gasoline, which, by the way, is still on my radar as to why people call it unleaded when we haven't sold leaded gas in about 30 years or more. We can stop calling it unleaded and just start calling it regular anytime now.
Well, see, now you're an Indiana guy. Now, if you were an Illinois guy, you would have noticed that the two-step going on the signs here. There's unleaded, and then there's regular unleaded. You don't have that yet, do you?
I have never seen a regular unleaded. Why would there be a difference when you're not selling anything?
They're trying to push, for those that don't, aren't car geeks, unleaded gasoline can contain up to 15% ethanol, and has for God knows how long. There's now a 15% unleaded.
Yeah, that's called E85 here.
No. The E85 is ethanol. That's 85% ethanol. I'm saying there's a...
No, it's 80. It's 15% ethanol.
Well, the E85 here is what they refer to.
It's, you know, 85% regular gas.
Right, I'm just telling you what it is here. Here, the E85 is the ethanol. It's 85% ethanol, 15% gas. There is now a new one. If you go buy, like, a discount gas station, there'll be something up top that's $4.89... And right under it'll be like $4.99. Well, the one under it is what you and I consider to be regular unleaded. That's the 10%. The one above it is 15% that evidently you can put in cars that are less than 5 years old or something. I don't know what the cutoff is, but I can't put it in mine. So when you pile in, there'll be a whole list across the bottom of it. Matter of fact, I pulled into a gas station coming back from Elwood where the only regular available was 15% of ethanol. I said, I can't put this in my truck. So I went to another gas station. When was the last time you got it'll go to another gas station? So here they're trying to wiggle everybody into this 15% ethanol. But I think certain cars can't use it or aren't supposed to use it. So that's another new grade. So if somebody says to you, what's regular unleaded, it's the traditional 10% unleaded. This is way more confusing than it ought to be, don't you think, guys?
Well, they can still stop using any reference to lead because it just is not, it's not part of the equation anymore.
No, but that, boy, that was the, other than stuff they use for Botox, was that stuff like the most poisonous compound on Earth? The tetraethyl lead?
Yeah, could have been bad.
I know I told a whole story the other day, my bro worked for GATX, they make tank cars. And if ever you could see, if I was in the car with them once, and all of a sudden these tiny little tank cars come by on the train, and they look like they were, you know, like they were, they had, you know, misspent uranium in there. They looked like they were a fort. He goes, those are tetraethyl lead cars. He goes, they're almost like they're armored, because if you ever spill that stuff, and when you get rid of them,
yeah, I know the cars you're talking about too. They're always all black.
Yeah, and he said when you get rid of them, they fill them up with concrete and dump them in the ocean. How scary is that?
Only for the sharks.
Yeah, only for the sharks. But anyway, you see a lot of. What do you think? I mean, the elections. I don't know. I don't know the connection between. I wish I did. Between representative elections and the economy. In some places there probably is. Some places there isn't. How do you even know? I mean, then you're right, Kevin. You look at gasoline because you listen to the. You know, I won't say morons because they're not morons. the people on TV, you know, shouting in the financial news, and all they talk about is gasoline and chicken, okay? But most people, if you do the math, as bad as the gas prices are, the average driver, I mean, what's the math? The average driver does 12,000 miles a year, okay? And the average car, let's say 20 miles at a gallon, so what is that? It's 600 gallons of gas, and you're up a buck, or 50 cents, it's 300 bucks. That is a pimple on the ass of an elephant. And whether or not your windows of your house are up three times in 5 years, or God help if you go to an emergency room. It's right in front of everybody's face, like you say, but it's just not that much dough. I mean, it just isn't. I mean, for a regular person, it's aggravating, but...
As a percent of your budget, it probably isn't, unless, you know, but it, you know, if you drive to work every day, like a lot of people do, then it's going to be an annoyance, and that's not going to go away. But like as I said before, it's not really even that's not the issue. The issue is just that it stands up and waves at you every single day, and that's, you know, that, you know, that's just a, you know, that's just a life thing, that, you know, if something is in your face all the time, it's going to be front and center. And, you know, I usually fill up at Costco, so I, you know, my price is going to be down anyway. Typically around here, $3.75 would be the mode. I would say, you know, from being out and about yesterday, it's, you know, that's still high, and I think people react to that.
Is that Indiana or Michigan?
Indiana. You know, I have to. All I have to do is drive about a mile the other direction to see what Michigan prices are. But, you know, when I get in the car, it's usually to, because I'm only a mile on the Michigan side of the state line. So, but I do almost all of my living, except for, you know, an occasional tavern or restaurant, and maybe a trip over to Niles. Almost all of my living is done in Indiana. I am, for all intents and purposes, an Indiana resident, because I shop in Indiana. Most of my entertainment is in Indiana, and my work is in Indiana. So, you know, I sort of behave that way. I could probably go out on a recon mission today and let you know what gas price is on the Michigan side of the border, where they haven't had a tax holiday. I haven't gone up there and looked.
Did the Indiana guy take off the state tax on gasoline, or did he take off the sales tax on gasoline?
I think it was the state tax, but I can't tell you off the top of my head. What, sure.
You know what? I guess when we dig down into this, I mean, the Maria Pappas came out in Illinois, and there's actually been some reasonable truth out of some politicians lately, scary as it may seem. I think she said for the last 30 years the property taxes, and this is a Mr. Flanagan question, have been double the rate of the published rate of inflation. They're not probably not double the rate of inflation that we all feel. But I wonder if that isn't, I use the term justified. I mean, you talk about, you know, the money they spend for, like, repairs to a bridge, or just to put new blacktop on the cost of all that stuff is gone. What do you suppose the inflation is on that vis-a-vis the CPI? I think it's got to be double. What do you guys think? I mean, it's just off the top of my head.
Yeah, probably. And I mean, just, and housing prices too haven't, you know, you can't really tie those to inflation. I mean, there's, I'm not sure. You could probably chart out pretty easily when this started to, you know, just go off on its own, as far as, you know, by how many, you know, points housing values went up starting about 1960 or so. But that too did not have anything, you know, to do with inflation after a while. And it's more acute now than ever. So in some ways, it's not that, you know, outlandish that the taxes have, you know, outstripped inflation, because the things they're supposedly based on have also just been disconnected from inflation.
Well, I got a little bit of a missive from a lady, she listens in Mississippi of all places. And I don't know what she does. I've never talked to her, but essentially she's somewhat involved in some renovation projects for a few of the classrooms, and they are absolutely stunned by the cost. Like, you got to be kidding me. What people are wanting. I mean, just, you know, regular, and, you know, without getting into a long political discussion, a lot of the reasons why some of the landscaping and things like that and were done was a lot of people were done, maybe weren't citizens, but what's the price of a new kitchen now? 50? 100? If you want a good one? I mean, everybody, yeah. You get a bunch of dumb politicians, they're not dumb, but unaware of, they don't go to Home Depot, let's put it that way. The limo doesn't stop there. We need low-cost housing. How the hell are you going to get low-cost housing when the house that somebody's buying is 400, and if you had to put it up tomorrow, it'd be 450? So how does putting up more housing, the economics would say, if we just built more houses, the price would come down. Duh, supply goes up. Wait a minute. If it costs you $450 to put the place up, you're not doing anybody any favors, are you?
Yeah, there's a demand side to the equation as well. And that was a big shift. And you go back to the COVID years, that was a big shift away from cities because people were kind of, you know, for enough years were locked out of being able to do anything in any city. So they wanted things like a yard.
Yeah.
You know, well, again, and so that, you know, that was a big shift in the way people looked at the housing market and looked at where they wanted to live. So, yeah.
Well, if you were in a high rise without a balcony, and God help you if you had a dog, because we had a little guy or a girl need to go out. I'll tell you what, I would have traded underneath a bridge for that. It had to be like prison. Not to mention the poor dog. If you can only use the elevator once every 6 hours, what's the poor dog going to do?
well, especially when you have social distancing in the elevators, too.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, one of my favorite things was, in elevators, seeing these spots that they put. You know, where you stand on this spot in this corner, somebody stand on the other spot, because, of course, you know it can't travel across the elevator. The things that we did that were supposedly science were so unscientific.
Well, you know, I was, and this is, I guess, more a Kevin question. As COVID went on, and you know, my brother was always giving me no end of grief about running everything off. God, you're doing nothing but killing trees. And I have a huge stack of, like, articles, you know, that I couldn't even see the machine. Finally, I sort of stopped doing that. But you know what? I'm sort of sorry I did, because so many articles during COVID, and maybe today is the same thing, I don't know, were all got scrubbed. I mean, I went to the one I always like to talk about was the airlines somehow went to Harvard University and how much they paid them for this horse bleep analysis. That somehow you were okay on a plane because of the ventilation system in a plane. You were actually safer in a plane than you were walking down the street. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. I'm not a germanologist, whatever you call those guys, but that can't be right. So I went back to Harvard did a similar study in like 1920 something about tuberculosis, which was I think every bit as infectious as COVID. I mean, who knows? But they said that as long as you were 3 feet apart, you were okay. Well, then somebody came out with a 6 feet on COVID. I'm saying none of this stuff matched up, yet it was the same place doing it. So you're sitting there going, how do you decide? Our friend Angelica, who did a show, Angelica is a very nice, very bright lady, and oh, by the way, amazingly easy on the eyes. She was walking down the lakefront one day, and it was a deal as you could walk, but you couldn't stop. So she gets a little tired. She sits on one of the park benches. She goes, I'm the only person within 200 yards. These two coppers come up and say, you got to keep moving. She goes, what are you talking about? You got to keep moving. Don't you know the law? I'm thinking these coppers just wanted the view of her walking away. What do you think?
Having met Angelica, I could imagine that they would.
Hey, you know, the stupid stuff we did, the people...
You know, and echo what you say, because, you know, people are sitting here thinking, Kevin, you pig, and yes, I am. But aside from that... She was a really great producer and a wonderful young woman. But yeah, you're right, very very pretty woman.
You know, she managed to get her mom out of Ukraine, and Dan had her over for Thanksgiving. She and her mom, and her mom is spectacular, just spectacular.
She's close to our age, or two. Hey, you know.
Well, she's.
And yet, you haven't introduced me.
She was here and went in like a week or two. I don't know how she got her out of the Ukraine, but she did. She in a week or two, she was taking English classes. She knows how to sew, so she was working at some cleaners doing alterations and had some other jobs somewhere else. She had two jobs in a class, all within like 3 weeks after she got here. That's pretty special, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very cool. But at any rate, yeah, there's a whole lot of people now that want us to forget all the stuff that they had going on that they made people do during that time period, and there is a lot of people denying it. There's people denying what they said about vaccine effectiveness. All the people that said it will prevent you from getting it and it will prevent you from spreading it, and now they're even trying to say that it will prevent you. It prevented more severe effects, which is nothing more than a hypothesis to start with, because that has never been tested and proven. But aside from that, it looks like, as you look at some of the mortality numbers, excess mortality numbers, it looks like it's quite the opposite. That if it didn't necessarily prevent severe disease, it has maybe promoted severe disease. But you start thinking about things like plowing over a skate park in California, like things like what you described in Chicago, that you couldn't stop on the lakefront, all this really stupid ass stuff that was going on, and now everybody wants to deny that they had any part of it and that they said anything like that, because now it is very inconvenient politically.
Well, it is, and I think, you know, I beg forgiveness from everybody, because I can't help myself. I go to the numbers, and you go back to the people who are the winners and the losers, and it's always the same people. Well, actually, the people who wrote those laws, and I think that most of that stuff, and I can't remember. I know the first couple of checks came out of Trump, and I honestly think that he might have. He wanted to send a third check, and Congress.
Oh, he did, and they wouldn't let him.
Yeah, yep. I think if he would have sent that, he might have won. I think that hurt him in the election. I mean, I don't know how much. I have no idea, but I think it definitely hurt him. And I don't know who did the business checks for, like, the restaurants. The what was the one? The Employment Retention Act, was that? Was that him or was that Biden? It was right about the time it turns.
The first round was probably Trump administration.
But the second one was the employee retention one. I think that one was Biden. And I'm not like Mr. Flanagan, Mr. Attorney. I don't usually read laws, but of course it affected our firm here. So I'm reading the damn thing and I go, wait a minute, who wrote this? Some restaurant guy. The difference between if you pick five or six restaurants and you find one that was able to stay open either with outdoor stuff or whatever and just didn't have to flat ass close, they got so much money versus the people who just plain flat ass closed. The difference it made in people's lives by the stupidity of the there was a lady, she had a was out here in Western Suburbs someplace, and she had a restaurant, I might as well say it. It was one of the Greek restaurants. The Greek people own them. They love the restaurant industry. Very strong, people, and they work their ass off. She's got this Greek restaurant, breakfast, lunch, that kind of place, across from, it was either a Sam's Club or a Costco, one of the two. And she goes, remember whenever we got shut down a second time? She made it through the first time. And then she had to shut down again the second time. And she goes, we're going out of business. She goes, look across the street. Basically, all those assholes are eating hot dogs over at the Sam's. It's not a problem there. Yet I can't serve a hot dog here. I mean, it was never even. And all the governors, maybe the three of us, when it looked like it was horrible, might have shut everything down for 2 weeks. But I would hope that even the fact that the three of us squabble on everything, I think we'd have been smart enough to drive by the Walmart that's wide open selling blue jeans and say, you know, we really should let the blue jean store open. Duh. I think the only thing, who was the governor of Michigan? Well,
in Michigan here, we actually had some stores like you know, Meijer and Walmart, places that sold additional things, and they roped off the parts that were they considered non-essential, so that you couldn't go buy the blue jeans or the whatevers. You couldn't buy them because everybody knows that COVID spreads in those part of the stores, but it does not spread on the grocery side of the store.
How is it? I mean, the one thing
it's just stupid stuff. You look at this, and it was stupid at the time. We talked about it a lot on the show. It was stupid at the time. It was obviously stupid at the time, and yet this got organized so much around, you know, political parties, and God, you know, what a horrible time in our country. The abject stupidity that was behind everything. Only, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that a lot of it was to cover up origins of this.
Well, that probably, you know, but here's one. I remember this because why I was even listening, but the governor of Michigan, I think it was Michigan, Kevin. John, you and I talked about this on the show at the time. The governor of Michigan did something. It was a she, right? She shut something down.
Gretchen Whitmer, yeah.
Yeah, she shut something down. And the question, now, why Pritzker put himself through a news conference every day, I have no idea, but he did.
They were all hand-picked questions, Todd. It was a no-brainer.
Actually, they weren't. Not in this one. And he's this is on a Sunday, and I'm driving back from the south side, and all of a sudden, whatever Whitmer did, Pritzker was reluctant to do, whether it was shutting something down the second time or whatever it was. He was, they had to be, well, I don't know who the hell they were, but they were all ladies. That's not a sexist comment, it's just the truth. Guys, they were on him like a monitor lizard on his leg. Wait a minute, you're not shutting it down when the governor of Michigan, you don't care if people die. They abused the guy. It wasn't like they were the questions that he wanted to ask. They abused him for a half hour. And when finally he said, I've had enough, I go, if there was one of those prediction markets, I would immediately make a bet that the next day he was going to close whatever she did in Michigan, and he did the same thing. They were pillaring him with questions like, how come she's looked to save lives and you're not? That kind of crap. The pressure that was put on some of these people by some of the press and I don't know who, you know, whoever they were, was pretty dramatic. If they were to say, we're closing all restaurants in Michigan, and here you say, well, if it's big enough, you can leave it open. I can't imagine the pressure you were under from whatever side that was, saying you had to shut everything down. People bought into that.
Yeah.
One of my buddies...
Well, some of the other stuff, you know, Whitmer is, you know, obviously near and dear to my heart. Can't stand that woman. But one of the things that she did was, of course, like every other governor, she declared a state of emergency and issued a bunch of orders about, you know, how we would, you know, what we could and couldn't do. But like most states, the state of emergency has a expiration date, and then once you hit the expiration date, you have to go back to your state legislature to get it approved. And because it was a Republican-controlled legislature, she was concerned that she would not get, you know, her agenda approved. And she's right, by the way. It wouldn't have been approved. So
she just renewed this unilaterally
renewed the state of emergency. And so that wound up being a court battle. And as soon as the court ruled against her, and she had to a number of the restrictions by state of emergency order were lifted, she immediately had her health department commissioner issue a new and different kind of state of emergency, a health department based state of emergency, so that she could re-implement all of this stuff despite what the court said. And of course that went back to court and got slapped down as a, you know, nice try type of ruling. But, you know, this was the mindset of so many of these politicians and these governors that, you know, you're damn well going to do what we tell you. We're not going to give you any choices. And yet there were other states that said, nope, we're going to trust our people.
Well, there's going to be, I mean, you could...
their own personal decisions, and they'll be all right.
Well, whatever you look at this, and we had Dr. Blade on, the question is, are the politicians leading the charge to immorality, or are they just reflective of everybody else? I mean, how does somebody who blows through every stop sign and for his whole life say Trump should pay attention to the Supreme Court? They don't pay attention to anything. I mean, why? I mean, it's,
well, this is, as long as you bring that up, he has paid attention to the Supreme Court.
Well, and no, he hasn't. In terms of tariffs, he hasn't.
Tell me more about that. Which orders did he ignore?
This whole concept.
He's lost some cases in the Supreme Court, and as far as I know, he's followed. You know, he's lived with the decisions, even when he didn't like them.
The idea of tariffs. The Supreme Court told him that's a tax. And all he did was shift to another stupid law.
What have they implemented? But if there is another law that you think interprets that allows not the same level of tariffs, by the way, but allows some tariffs, and you're following the law, has anybody this doesn't fit.
The point is that they are a tax that Congress is supposed to deliver. The House. All tax bills are supposed to come from the House. Trump thinks he can do it on his own. He has no intention of. But he's not. My point is, he's not the only one. He's reflective.
But every time he's had a court order, he's followed it.
Followed it and found another way to work around it.
I think you're talking about one instance of trying to find a way around it. I'm not even sure what's been implemented. What's been implemented there?
I think right now the tariffs are higher in most countries than they were before.
I think anything that was part of an agreement in the past has been kept in place.
Well, can you think of a worse scenario?
But Tom, you're going to have to come up with, you know, if you're going to make that claim, here's what he did in defiance of the court order, and you don't have anything.
Yes, I do. This is now the second war in Iran. We're not going to Congress. We got 60 days. Oh no, we ended that war. It's a new war. It sounds like your governor in Michigan.
I'm sorry, which new war? Which new kinetic war?
Well, because we had a ceasefire, the stuff we do in Iran now, he doesn't need to worry about the 60 days that the original, basically going to war on your own without going to Congress. You don't have to worry about the 60 days because it's a new war.
Have we done a new incursion into Iran?
We just bombed them the other day.
Was that in response to...
Everything's in response to something. I mean, I'm saying the line of bullshit. The fact is, you're supposed to go to Congress for wars. I mean, let's not get into that. But I'm saying at the end of the day, I get it.
You're not allowed to shoot back.
No, okay. You are allowed to shoot back. But I'm saying, I started this by saying everybody seems to think everything's a workaround. He's not alone. I mean, everybody seems to think the laws are for everybody else right now. My question was, which way is it coming? Is it coming from the top down or is it coming from the bottom up? I don't know. Does anybody pay attention to any rules? We do because we're from that generation, but does anybody else?
I still think you got to come up with an example.
Okay. I got two. There's still tariffs on people. And by the way, we're still in a war and he never went back to Congress after 60 days. There's two.
There's still also having to pay back tariffs.
My next question is, can you think of anything sort of in keeping, and John, I'd like to hear your opinion on it, sort of in keeping with my every time there's a crisis, we put money into the system and we help out certain members of society. If I were to write a fiction book that said, gee, we had a president, or whoever, could have been Congress, by the way, we had a government that put through a whole bunch of tariffs that they probably shouldn't have, a lot of people paid like a lot extra in taxes because the government got, how much was, as Carl tells us, how much they get every month. And all of a sudden the tariffs are considered illegal. Then the tariff money goes back to the companies and not the people that they filtered down to. And oh, by the way, we found another law to bring back almost as much tariffs going forward. Can you even write, if Mr. Flanagan, probably the one of us that could be an author, wrote that in a book, would he sell copy number one? Can you think of even anything more bizarre?
Well, they sold worse things than that, huh?
What I'm saying,
the idea during COVID that nobody had to pay their rent or their mortgage. So landlords, you know, couldn't collect their rent. Tenants didn't have to pay it. If you had told me any point in my life, long before I was a lawyer, that somehow somebody could dream that up and enforce it and make people abide by it and not consider what the consequences would be. I mean, it's staggering to me.
Hey,
of all the COVID stuff, of all the whatever, to me, that's the thing that and the schools even worse, but the idea of rent abeyance and nobody's obligated.
John, do me a favor, because I don't know. When you didn't have to pay your rent that month, does that mean you never had to pay it, or you had to pay it when things got better?
It meant you could litigate it forever and skate on it.
But I mean, you didn't.
People did.
Okay, but so you're saying that if I was a renter, which I am, I could have just said, I'm not paying like this month and you're never getting it, or do I have to pay you later?
Well, I'm just not going to pay you, and I'm going to move out, and nobody's going to be able to charge me there either.
Oh, okay. You know?
Yeah, I think it accumulated, but good luck collecting it after the fact. And the big problem with that was, the stated intention was, hey, people can't work, therefore they can't pay rent. We can't be throwing everybody out into the streets. I get the thought process there. The small problem with that is that it totally screwed landlords, individuals, small landlord owners, and as a result, a whole big number of small properties got snapped up by larger property owners, because if you don't have the cash, if you don't have any cash flow from your property, then you can't go on forever. So people with deeper pockets wound up buying up the properties. And so it was just a big wealth transfer from small landlords to larger landlords.
Well,
and drove up the cost of repairs and rehab and everything else too. Nobody get money to put into buildings. So.
Well, Kevin, you're spot on in this point. I'm never supposed to say that for you, but don't you think that they're? I don't know if government's capable of this on any level. Don't you think that there should have been some sort of coordination? To give you an example of how much I think you were correct on this is when I, the night before COVID, when we were shutting down, I frequent three places. I went to every one of them and bought a drink. And I said, I just want to know when this is all over. I'm sure the place will reopen. I just want it to reopen under the same ownership. And they all did, thankfully. But like when you talk about the soybean farmers, the first tariff fight, the Trump administration had with China, a lot of the northern soybean farmers went under. Well, the farms are back, but a lot of other people now own those farms. So it's never, Kevin, you don't realize how spot on you are with all this stuff. I always thought that, let's say, for instance, my pet peeve on all this crap is there's no, let's say, for instance, if we owned a brokerage firm, which I do, the COVID was horseshit. We were 2 years without seeing a client in the office. The people I used to meet in restaurants, there was no restaurants open. I mean, it was horrible for us. But we paid everybody, and we got a little help from the government, but we used it for payment. But now what if we were smart enough to go out and buy a garbage company? They never missed a paycheck. Garbage always got picked up. And yet they got all the money to pay those people for, a year? Now, if you're one of those people, and you're still getting paid, by the way, everybody here was getting paid, why should anybody here, or why should anybody who works for the garbage company who can't prove that you were losing a paycheck, why should you not have to pay your rent? Right. I mean,
it's pretty clear to me now, Tom, that, once they decided we can make people believe anything we want about where this thing came from and how dangerous it is and what we've got to do to prevent, mass extinction of the population, it was very carefully coordinated, really, after that. You could make people feel that they didn't have to go into work, that, buildings could not, collect rents on you know, commercial properties, because there's no way you could run a legal business out of these places. Restaurants couldn't survive. Downtown areas would have to cave.
Some restaurants had their best years ever and made out like a bandit. Some.
Well, and some places didn't even blink, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, hotel chains could have health clubs. You couldn't have an independent health club open.
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it? Well, we could.
But I mean, all this carefully coordinated time. This wasn't just, oh my God, what are we doing here? They knew exactly what
we got to go to the other guys. But the question I started the money supply, and I started with the crisis. There are people that are nice people in this world, and I include my brother as one of them. But you can imagine we squabble too, brothers. He still firmly believes, you know, not in every case, that somehow or another, people may have made, looking back on it, incorrect decisions, but they were made for the right reasons. Even the Fed, you know, and Greenspan went to 1%. He did it for what he thought was the right reason. And I don't know, maybe I look at the outside stuff on the firm more than he does or something. Every single time something like this happens, the big guys win. Like John just said, the restaurants and the hotels, they were open, other people weren't. Every single time, the same group wins and the same group loses. And I'm just not about to say that this is a random, you don't flip a coin 50 times and come up heads 50 times without it being a rigged coin. I'm just saying. And I don't know if you guys agree with me or not. But
Go ahead, John.
No, you go again.
Well, you know, from Dan's point of view, there were people, I think, in the business world, I was even, you know, somewhat sympathetic to some of the people who were making decisions, saying, you know, I think, you know, like if you're making it for a college, for example, and you're saying I'm responsible for thousands of people here, and I have to make decisions that, you know, are in their best interest. The problem is that you were making decisions based on information that was a lie, and it was an intentional lie. So you may have had people with right motivations, but their right motivations were driven by lies from people who should have, you know, who had influence over those decisions. And that's the big problem. And I'm pointing at, you know, the whole healthcare apparatus in government as the primary offenders.
Kevin, we got to dash to the other guys. Answer me this question. Bodius. And I would get the same answer out of Wayne and Andrew when they come in. Do you think it was? I don't think it was a lie from day one. I think when it got so bad, where the people in Milan, everybody's going down there, and when the group from Boston Scientific came to the big convention in Boston, and they had how many super spreaders in that group, and it was running around like a man. I don't know the day one, if somebody would have just shut everything down for 2 weeks, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit in my brother Dan's camp on this one. I'm not sure day one it was a lie. It became a lie very rapidly in terms of now you're seeing stuff, and why is this place open and that open? Well, this guy's benefiting, this guy is. It became a lie fairly rapidly, but I don't know that it was a lie on day one. Do you?
Yes, I think it was a lie on day one.
I do.
When you look at the documentation that's available now of the communications among Fauci and others, they knew damn well that this came out of gain-of-function research, and they knew damn well that they were in trouble when that got exposed. So they did everything they could to shape a different conversation, and that different conversation was built around, hey, we don't know what this is. This is a big challenge, and we have to therefore react with this abundance of caution.
You were burying people in nursing homes. I mean, the initial onslaught was pretty bad.
Yeah, we knew where the vectors were. We knew darn well that that nursing homes were a problem. And that we probably shouldn't have been sending sick people back into nursing homes, which we did, which my governor did, Whitmer did here, and which famously happened in New York. We knew about all of that, and yet did things anyway. But even worse was that we just tried to cover the tracks of the people who were ultimately responsible for this, and that's a big problem.
Well, if you had put all those people in jail on day one, I don't know that it would have made all that much difference in the first month or so. But hey, a question for you, and I don't even know what executive orders are or whatever, but allegedly Obama had an executive order to not fund the gain-of-function research that Trump reversed when he came into office. I don't think that made any difference, do you? I mean, I don't know if anybody paid attention to Obama, I don't know if anybody paid attention to Trump. I think they did a workaround and went through North Carolina and somewhere in Britain, right? I don't think I want to blame that one on Trump.
Yeah,
I mean,
they just funneled money to third parties that
yeah, that's what I mean. I don't think people paid attention, because I've read stuff that, you know, Obama reversed the executive order, which was pretty dumb to do, but I don't think it really made any difference, do you? I mean, I don't think anybody paid attention to the Obama order, which means that Trump reversing it probably didn't make any kind of practical difference, did it? I don't think. I mean, I don't know.
I think there was enough power and influence in the medical field, I think, and the pharmaceutical field later on to whatever they wanted to do, whether they had permission to do it, whether it was legal to do it, you know, was kind of irrelevant to the people who were doing this stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Because they knew they could eventually twist the narrative enough to, you know, absolve themselves in the public's eye for having anything to do with anything so crooked as testing stuff in Wuhan or anyplace else, and then having it let loose, which is pretty much confirmed now. But back then, whether there had been an executive order preventing that or not, there still would have been.
Yeah, there was, and I don't think it would have made any difference. We got to dash to the other guys.
There was enough power in influence to get the result they wanted once they started to see that their narrative about this was going to suffer. They could muscle their way, you know, in every way possible, say the kids were at risk and therefore we got to close the schools. All this BS, total BS. And they knew they could make people swallow it.
Well, like I said, I think I'd absolve them if they did it for 2 weeks and realized it was too much and backed off, but they should. So, Kevin, how come John's not one of these Master of the Universe kind of guys?
I have no idea.
I
was pretty much thinking that was more like Russell and Larissa would be the Masters of the Universe, but they can tell us.
Not. You know, well, you know, just remember, John, as you become a master, I'm not going to go for a ride in any boat I got to step down into.
You know, this might be the last time that Larissa and I are on, because you've offended us tremendously.
What did we do?
You were talking about one of the other hosts, and you go, he's probably the only one among us that could write a book. Larissa's published a book. I published 11.
I was talking about the three of us on the air at that moment.
But we were here. We were here.
Here.
Pay attention to the board.
And just as a shout out, my new book is coming out June 2nd. Pre-orders are available. Candlestick Charting for Dummies. You can buy it on Amazon, Target, and all of your major retail places you buy books.
Why don't we have a book signing?
We will schedule a book signing.
I don't know how well book signings do on the radio, guys. Come on.
Well, we'll push it here, but if you have one down in
Dude, I have published 8 books since I have been on with you, and you have never offered it. You know, I know where I stand in the pecking order. I'm just gonna.
You never said down. Like she just
you
did.
You guys go ahead.
You never brought it out
Russell,
there in the air.
Russell, I would love to tell you that you know that you don't stand that far down in the pecking order, but in fact you do.
I know where I am on the totem pole, man. It's just like you know the family I married into. Every time a baby comes along, I get pushed down more. Every time a new host comes on, I get pushed down more.
Well,
we most definitely want to have a book signing. You know, a lot of people do those at bookstores. I think we need to do it at a tavern, though.
Well, without a doubt.
Yeah.
The
sounds very reasonable.
You know, Dr. J had a book signing, and there was a big line for the book, and the guy goes, I don't really want to wait in line. I go, well, I'll sign it. And the guy goes, okay. What does my signature in somebody else's book do for anybody?
Sean Spicer was pushing his book the other day on his podcast, and you can email him, tell him how you want the inscription made out, and he'll send you a signed book plate for what, however, you know, much money. He'll sell you a copy of the book too, and put the book plate in it for you, or I'll just send you the book plate so you can slap it on the cover and say it's a signed copy.
Well, if ever you ever want to get a guest, all you have to do is find somebody that just published a book. Who was Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors chief? The hell was the guy's name? He was one of my guests. He could have been
right.
Could have been the worst guest I ever had. He still comes on once in a while, even though he's 100 years old. God, what the hell's his name? He came out, he was the absolute worst guest because he had his spiel for his book, right? And I wanted to ask him questions because he was a real famous guy. I mean, it was okay, it was Clinton's, whatever, I'll think of the name. And he came in and he just talked for like 15 minutes and never had to take a breath. And I'm going, is this guy a lizard? Does he have a lung at the bottom? he never stopped talking. I never got a question. And then he goes, I'm out of here, and left. Okay, then.
Oh, you're not talking about Robert Reich, are you?
Summers. Was it Summers? Yeah.
Larry Summers?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was like, just gave this huge spiel and was gone. I never even got a chance to ask a question. And the guy didn't even take a breath. I'm like, he's not even human.
Anyway. That, you know, if I had been on that day, I would have known that I could just go into nap mode.
Oh, God. My two worst guests, not that anybody asked, but the other one was Kathy Dervin got me a guy from Finland who was on the European, whatever the group, what do they call it, the European Parliament or something, the one that's in Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there like 500 or 600 people in that thing?
Yeah.
It's a huge amount. Well, he got on and they had just voted to leave the Brexit in Britain. And the guy gets on and he goes, it's another example of politicians that failed to educate their people on the right thing that they should do. And I sit there and go, what did you just say? I can't believe the guy. And he was dead serious. The British politician failed in telling their people what they were supposed to do. And the best thing was what he wanted them to do. And I'm going, wow, there's an attitude.
Yeah.
But anyway.
We know better. Damn it, we know better.
Yeah. So, guys, what did you do for Memorial Day? Did you do any Memorial Day stuff?
I have to sign off, guys. Larissa, okay. Russell.
All right, take care. John, thanks for piling in because we
I'll be listening.
The what'd you guys do for Memorial Day? Anything special? I actually did, but I'm asking you.
I spread dirt.
Actually, I did that too. On Saturday we did the Memorial Day.
I spread dirt. Yeah. We're still settling into to one of the houses we moved into. So I got to do that kind of stuff.
What'd you plant?
I don't know. You're asking the wrong person.
Well, I planted some tomatoes.
I spread dirt.
Well, the
and you know, took a 2x4 and leveled it out.
Oh, there you go.
You know, all those kinds of things. Yeah.
I was down in Elwood, Illinois, at the National Cemetery, the Abraham Lincoln Cemetery.
Oh, wow.
And I would have lost this bet. The thing opened in late 1999. Guess how many people are buried there?
I'm counting how many. 25,000.
80.
80 people are buried
80,000.
80,000? Oh, my gosh. In military?
Yeah, all military. Yeah. Well, I mean, we're military and spouse.
99. Now, what I was trying to do real quick was what are the number of days in 25 years?
Well, I'm going to say, and this is
number of days in 25 years. If you could bury one person a day, that's really what I was trying
to do. I did the math. It's like 10 a day.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
And just as a stab, I'm going to say a little over half, maybe way more than half, have actual graves, and the rest have the walls where you put like the urns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Every single grave had a flag. So there had to be like 40,000 flags. I'm like, who the hell did that? You're out in the middle of absolutely in the middle of nowhere. Listen, I don't know if you know, the old Joliet Arsenal had amazing amounts of property. And I guess they used to blow stuff off there. And they rustle, the history of it. And part of that arsenal area is now this national cemetery.
Okay.
And so then Audrey and I went to the VFW in Wilmington. Because those are the guys, the old codgers that come out and shoot off the guns. But there's got to be 10 funerals a day. And they donate their time. You can't give them any dough. So we went to the VFW and did my best. I left a big fat tip, and everybody was happy about that. But I mean, these guys, all these people just donate all their time for all this stuff. I mean, it's really something.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that's what we did. But Elwood is a, it's where Jake and Elwood Blues, right? That's where Elwood was named from Elwood.
Well, that sounds like something that Larissa did this weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, so yeah. I have two stories in for you. But with Elwood, I showed my kids this past weekend Blues Brothers.
They must have loved it.
Well, and I fast forward all the talking parts because they're still small children. And but yeah, they loved it. And the eldest was really funny when Ray Charles came on, and he says, he's blind? Yeah, he's blind. He can play the piano. Yeah, he can play the piano. Yeah. And it was just really funny. And then, because I have a 5-year-old, the song "Shake Your Tail Feather," where everybody bends over and shakes their tail feather. Oh, he was just eating it up. It was like the greatest thing ever. We're also big fans of the number "The Favorite by the Horns," "Stand by Your Man," and they were just dying. They thought it was the greatest thing ever.
I like the line. We do both kinds of music, country and Western.
Country and Western. And they were they were just dying. And some of it they didn't quite understand because, again, they're just young. But they could appreciate the big musical numbers. So my little guy, or my eldest, is now nicknamed Mr. Marvelous. So I've been calling him Mr. Marvelous all weekend, and he has thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you see there was a, I don't know, it was on History Channel or what, somebody did a documentary of all the places that were used in the movie and what happened to them. You know, most of them are all like gone and stuff. It's the big diner was on Maxwell Street, that's gone. The guitar shop's gone. I mean, there's no life in that keyboard. What do you mean? There's plenty of life in this keyboard. And really amazingly done, wasn't it? I mean, but they had a Joliet Prison, which is closed now. They had a big baseball game there a couple of weeks ago because there used to be a diamond on the, you know, in the prison where people come play the prisoners. Well, the Joliet Jackhammers actually had a game there. Bill Murray was there and the mayor of Joliet, and I wish I'd have gone. It was big, kind of a big deal. It's kind of a creepy place when you go by. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to do a tour, but it's pretty haunted.
The tour is awesome.
You went? Is it good?
Oh, yeah. The tour is absolutely awesome. And it's not too scary. I actually encouraged Larissa to take her kids there just to scare them straight. Because it's not really, it's not frightening at all. And actually, it's a pretty amazing how vast it is.
Oh, it's huge. The property is miles. It's like a mile.
I mean,
long.
It's just amazing how vast. I mean, it's like if you spit, you know, if you were stuck there for 20 years or so, it's not like you're stuck in something the size of a high school football stadium. You know what I mean? I've only spent a couple of nights in jail. I've never been in prison, and you know, I can see how it wouldn't make you overly stir crazy because of just how big it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's the brickwork and everything has got so old. How old is that place?
It's I can't really remember, but we went a couple of years ago around Halloween and just did a tour of it. And you basically just they you buy a ticket and you wander around. You should go down there and just wander around. It's kind of cool.
I'm not a larcenous guy, but I wouldn't mind lifting one of those signs that say "Don't pick up hitchhikers" when you go by the place. Interesting. I want to talk a little bit about we started the show, but hey, Larissa, what?
I wanted to interject. And then on Memorial Day, I took them to Cad Tigny.
Okay, well, that's a neat place.
Oh, it was. Awesome. Oh, my goodness. The kids had such a great time, and we went through the museums, and they actually spent quite a bit of time speaking with a couple of veterans. And it was really amazing to watch them start to understand the importance of what Memorial Day is all about, understand what it means to fight for freedom, understand what it means to stand up for people you love, and standing up for what's right. And so having those conversations, and again, being there, and of course they enjoyed climbing the tanks, but all of it was just such a great experience, and it was such a beautiful day. If you haven't been out there, I highly recommend it. It's such a great park.
Larissa, when I went there, God, I think I must have been in high school. It was mostly World War One. Has it been expanded to include more than that now?
It included World War Two.
Okay.
I had a slightly uncomfortable conversation with my children. They hadn't learned about Hitler yet. And so starting those conversations of this is what had happened, this is why we were fighting, this is why we got involved, this is how Japan attacked the United States. And then, interesting because of that jumped into the conversation, well, have the United States ever been attacked again? Well, yes, they have, and explaining what September 11th was all about, because they do learn about 9/11 in school, but I don't think the impact is great for when they're learning about it, because it's not personalized enough for them. It's not tangible, and being there made it so much more real. And I got the impression that they were very somber about it, and they were very fascinated by it. And one of the museums, they set it up so it looks like you're going through the trenches, and then you go through the jungles. So they, of course, ate up all the experience. And there's real bullets, there's real grenades, and because they're little boys.
Larissa, who was the guy who did that? It wasn't the Tribune guy. Who was the guy who actually put that place together?
I would assume Ken Tingney, but I don't know.
But I mean, what I used to know. What was he? He was a was it a big farm that he did that with, or what was the thing originally? Did you also learn the history?
It was the McCormick family.
McCormick, okay, that's what I thought. The Tribune people, right?
Yeah,
the
McCormick's all, the McCormick family. That was they had an estate out there, and they donated it.
He was the guy who owned the Trib, right?
Yep.
And he hated Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Do you guys, is there any, I mean, me being a little bit older, there's a you know, a real family history to, you know, the losses in World War II and how people were affected. I mean, virtually everybody was affected. And even the stuff that I've learned from Lou regarding my uncle, who was killed over there and was buried here 4 years later. I mean, some of the stuff that happened and the people who were included and not included, I mean, no women were included in the GI Bill, were they? Even if they were nurses overseas for 3 or 4 years? Even none of the people in the Waves and the Wax, I don't think, were. One of my uncles was in a construction group, and I don't think he was in the Army. I mean, in fact, I'm pretty sure he wasn't. But he went to Hawaii, and I think he repaired, you know, some of the battleships that they got back going. I mean, he didn't do it personally, but he did something over there. He was never GI Bill or anything like that, never was able to go to a veteran's hospital or anything like that. A lot of people, they're teams of mostly women, that if there was my uncle got killed taking a bridge from France to Germany. So they must have just put all the bodies in a hole, covered them up, took one of the dog tags. And Lou says years later, these teams of ladies would go and open up the hole to all these dead bodies not embalmed, which I can't even imagine what that would be like, match the dog tags up to the body, and then contact the family and say, do you want them buried in a cemetery here? Because evidently there's cemeteries all over Europe where American people are in. There's one in Normandy, I think. And or we'll send the body home, and you can do with it what you want there. Do whatever you want. Bury it at home. And my family elected to have the body sent back here. I had no idea. When you go by the gravestone and you see my Uncle Johnny died on X day in 1945, I never dreamed he wasn't buried till 1948. Then there were people who tried to enlist and couldn't because they were welders and so forth. And all of a sudden, the people who did enlist and made it back got the GI Bill, and the people who were welders never did. It was a massive. There was all kinds of stuff going on economically and whatever. I mean, you could have a class on that. What people got promoted up. Well, of course, if you went and you didn't come back, you didn't get to do the GI Bill. I mean, if you were black from the South, it wouldn't let you into college, and oh, by the way, you couldn't get a mortgage, so that didn't help you much. If you were black and in New York or Chicago, it helped you a lot, because you could actually go to a school here. mean, it was, when you start looking at the nuances of this, it's really something, isn't it?
It really is. And it's interesting, the selection of people that were allowed to be promoted up. And I know we've talked quite a bit about how the GI Bill has had such a long-lasting implication to tuition costs. And it is just overwhelming when you think about the sheer number of people that were out there fighting, and then the sheer number of people who were, as you put it, or described, the women who were essentially fighting for the war, but fighting from the home, or fighting in the U.S., meaning that they're going...
Well, there were a lot that were overseas. I mean, there were massive nursing battalions and stuff.
Sure, but then there's also the women that worked in factories and did things like that, and they were contributing to the war. It wasn't... My point is that there's a substantial amount of people that contributed to the war that don't necessarily get that recognition.
Right. One of the ladies at the Pullman, she was... This is, you know, back a ways, but she was probably in her early 60s. And she was, I'm going to say, Larissa, 5'4", 115 pounds on a bad day. And she was a welder during the war. And what a terrific lady. And I said, what was it like? She goes, Tom, it's man's work. It's, men are stronger than women. You pick up big pieces of metal and you weld stuff. It's okay for you guys. For me, it was horrible, but I had to do it. I mean, and she, you know, she didn't go into some long spiel about women can do whatever. She goes, maybe if I was twice my size, it would have been okay. It was pretty bad. I mean, she goes, you know, that was for the guys, and there weren't any guys. There was there was a massive a book, Freedom from Fear. I didn't realize that the Army, I'm going to use round numbers here, we got as high as like 4 million men or something, Russell. The Army always wanted 5. And yet the people who were producing stuff said, well, if you take another million, you're not going to have anything to shoot with.
Yeah.
So there was this constant fight back and forth between... I mean, my uncle was, whatever he was, 4-something-something, because he was a tool and die maker. He couldn't go anywhere. But, you know, you learn from some of these guys, I mean, the whole concept that we didn't do anything, no preparation whatsoever, and all of a sudden on December 7th, everything sprung into action. It's total BS. We were already selling stuff to the people in Europe, and Roosevelt was pretty knowledgeable that we might end up in this. They had already bleep canned a lot of the generals. I mean, Marshall was already making sure that the 70-year-old generals were gone and the other people were in. We were already building a lot of this stuff up. We were designing new ships, designing stuff. I mean, it wasn't anything like after Pearl Harbor, but there was some real preparation to this. I mean, you don't just, no matter what you do, you can't make a battleship in 2 weeks. You know, I mean, it had to be, a lot of this stuff started in the late 30s, and we were already kind of on our way because we were selling stuff to other people. I mean, Pullman was already making British tanks before
they converted Ford and all those guys.
Yeah, Pullman was already making the tanks. And I think they were making a landing craft for somebody. So there was already some of that going on. That was, you know, it wasn't like, oh man, we're going to start tomorrow at, you know, after December 7th. But yeah, why don't we do a quick break here, guys, and come back. I want to ask you about this market. And when are you going to sell your Micron, Russell? For God's sake.
Oh my goodness gracious. Yeah. I've got a good story around that.
SP Futures up 25, NASDAQ Futures up 249. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Loan Roll Pay Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P Futures up 24. NASDAQ Futures up 240 as we continue this huge run. And we've got Micron up another 64 hours, only up like 130 yesterday. It's like, let's see, what is that? Let's say $190 at billion one outstanding. God, that's kind of a lot, $200-some billion in market cap in like 2 days. That's a number. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 106.4%, FTSE up 8, call that flat. CAC around up 66.8, so bullish over there. Nikkei up 3, call that flat. Hang Seng down 271, that's a full 1%. Shanghai down 51, that's 1.25%. Asia Pacific markets don't exactly like the bullish thing today, but I'm not sure why that is. Bonds down 2 base points, 4.46, so the 10 years under 4.5. Japan 2.69, so they're actually up a little bit. Oil down $5, 88.42, we haven't seen that in a while. Brent down $4, 94.75. RBOB down 14 cents at 307, so we should be seeing gasoline prices somewhere in the $4 range pretty soon from the 480 they are now here. Gold down $46. We don't like no stinking gold, 44.56. Silver down $1.20, 75.33. Market seems really confused as to where gold and silver are going to land in this whole thing that's going on here. Foreign exchange, 116 on the dollar. The yen, 159.33, which is right near Russell and everybody else's 160 intervention number. Crypto, down 67, 75, 790. They've been real quiet, too. Kind of same thing as gold and silver, kind of in the confused area. Yesterday, the market way up, though. S&P up 45, NASDAQ up 312. A lot of that Micron. We got it for us real quick, Traffic Weather Sports. By the way, Russell and I we're in the batting order today for the Cubs. They figure we can't do any worse.
Yeah, that's right. It's Wednesday, May 27th. It is 7:37 here in Chicago. And, yeah, it's the first thing I was going to say. The Cubs' losing streak is up to 10 games right now. As yesterday, they lost to the Pirates 1-12. Sox haven't been doing much better or much worse. Yesterday, they lost to the Twins 3-5. Diamondbacks, however, basically doing the opposite of the Cubs. They won 9 out of their past 10 games. They just won over the Giants 7-5. For Chicago, weather is currently 69 degrees. We're going to have a high of 74. These warm-ish temperatures are going to stay throughout the day. We're going to have partly sunny skies, and temperatures will lower a little bit in the afternoon. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 70 degrees. They're going to have a high of 96. It's going to be sunny all day over there. And finally, for Chicago traffic, the inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 26 minutes. Eden's from Lake Cook is going to take you 40. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 39 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 29 minutes. And the Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 46 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you.
Guys, I was lobbing out a couple of themes here this week. A lot of it stemmed from Larissa last week talking about how some of the top part of the K is crumbling a little bit. But it strikes me as these crises seem to blend together in all the years I've been in a business that, in mortal words of Rahm Emanuel, never waste a good crisis. The idea that every time something bad happens in the world, we use the excuse to pour money in the system and separate some people from other people. I mean, the idea of what's going on, and you've been talking about it, Russell, and so has John Lee was on because he had just been in Japan. The inflation over there and the other individual Japanese people are not all that happy with what's going on. Yet, lo and behold, Japanese market is an all-time high. Same thing here.
Yeah.
I mean, lo and behold.
And I was at I've been able to do a little bit around conference season, and one of the things that a person from Eurex, I went to a thing in New York that Eurex put on a few weeks ago. One of the things they said is, inflation to a certain point can be good for asset prices, and Japan, a little bit of inflation is different than a little bit of inflation here, because they had no inflation for so long that prices were associated with different products. Like they had, a certain bottled tea that was 7,900 yen, and it'd been 7,900 yen for 30 years. And all of a sudden, they're having to, you know, kind of like Costco not giving up on the $1.50 hot dog quite yet. They had to break price on that. And that's extremely noticeable when your whole life something has cost the same price and all of a sudden it's a different price. So it's not, you know, the bout of inflation, I don't think, is terrible for them. It's just they're not as used to it. And since you mentioned Japan, and Larissa knows this, your favorite college student, my oldest daughter, just landed in Los Angeles coming back from 3 weeks in Asia.
Good for her.
She did that, yeah. And because she's between media jobs right now, I think I can get her on next week.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I know you've missed her terribly.
I have.
So I might be. She's going to be in town, so I might bring her down to see you.
All right. That doesn't mean we're going to dump Larissa.
Yeah. So no, of course not. But you know, a certain amount of inflation does bleed through to asset prices. You know, that's part of the bump that we've seen in the stock market lately, and that, you know, it's not shocking that it bled through to asset pricing in Japan.
Why do you say only a certain amount?
Because if you get to excessive inflation, it's gonna result in then your central bank having to take action and raise rates, which is going to slow the economy, which is going to be bad for, you know, at least investment assets.
Except they seem to be pretty good at not letting that happen now.
They're trying to.
Well, they buy the assets.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's...
They've been buying... I think at one point, over half of the ETFs in Japan were owned by the central bank. So if you think the intervention's bad here, you got no idea.
Well, those guys, plus the, I believe that a lot of, one thing I think we still have going for us here is banks, stocks are not good capital on a bank's balance sheet in this country. They are in Europe, they are in Japan. That's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge difference. I mean, when John and I were lecturing in Europe in, 1991, the banks owned stock in all the companies.
Yeah.
It's a
whole, God, I forgot what the term was for it. It's like these vertical, a large tech company, or let's say Honda. Honda would use the same bank and the suppliers would use the same bank. And it was almost like there were these silos of, you know, integrated businesses that were closely tied together, and they had a phrase for it.
You know what the term is? It's a very fascist economic system. That, I'm not talking about, you know, putting people in railroad cars. I'm talking about as an economic system that's very old school German and very fascist, where you have a few industries, a few companies in every industry, maybe with the banks owning the stock, and the banks with the nose up the ass of government. It's a very controlling sort of thing. And we're actually going the same direction here now, with the government taking pieces of companies. And all of a sudden, they're the winners, and God help you if you're competing against a company that is going to get all the government business. We're going the same direction here. But it's an economic system of... It's all about control. There's no... I got no feeling of any entrepreneurial gist when I was in Frankfurt or Vienna back in 1991. I mean, there's no way you could start a brokerage firm, no way you could start a law firm. It wasn't happening. If you weren't into it and your grandpa wasn't in it, just a different world. And I thought we'd never get there, but maybe we're getting there. I hope not. Just saying.
They refer, it's called Kuritsu.
Okay.
And I know I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but it's where, like, you know, a supplier might be 25% owned by their biggest customer, and there's all this cross ownership, and it's just unique to the Japanese economy. I don't think there's anything nefarious there or anything, other than they all had to work tightly together, you know, starting about 80 years ago to try to compete globally, because they were trying to recover from some things.
Well, I'm not saying you shouldn't understand. I'm saying don't equate it with any kind of competitive capitalism.
No. It's not. It It's kind of, you know, the type of competitive that China's trying to do as well, where, you know, they have national champions, and the government, you know, the government is very supportive of the, you know, very, very supportive of companies to the point of trying to help them cheat a bit. Which leads me to an interesting historical thing I came across that you're going to love. And I'll be very embarrassed if you already knew this. But the original creation of the Central Intelligence Agency was supposed to be a government agency that helped businesses compete globally.
Well, I thought it came out of the OSS during the war.
Well, it fell under the OSS, but the OSS was separate. And the Central Intelligence Agency was really supposed to be, I don't want to say industrial espionage, but, you know, a bunch of large companies were putting this intelligence service together, and they went to the government and they said, you know, we're going to do this with or without you. Do you want it? And the government kind of took it over. But one of the initial intents of the CIA was kind of what China does, stealing IP and things like that.
When was the, Larissa, pile in here anytime. When did the OSS essentially become the CIA? Was there some sort of a big congressional bill that formed one versus the other? And I don't know the history of that, do you?
I don't know that.
Because the OSS was essentially the brother of was the MI6, right? In Britain. Because of the two bills. Bill Stevenson ran the British Secret Service and Bill Donovan ran the OSS, right?
Again, I have
no. Yeah, no, I know what you're. Yeah, and the OSS was like part of the army.
Yeah.
Because Diana Prince in the TV series Wonder Woman, that was set during World War II, and she was like somebody's secretary in the OSS.
Well, what's his name?
That's how I know what the OSS is.
Well, the British, actually, if it's not a long read, but we used to have one in the office, but one of our guys took it and then died of cancer and I got it back, but that's another story. But Larissa, if you get a chance, read a book, A Man Called Intrepid. It's the guy who was the head of the British Secret Service. And when you talk about our politicians today versus these guys, this dude was he was one of the inventors of television. He was a serious mathematician. He also was a light heavyweight boxing champ for 5 years in Britain. And talk about a resume. And he was the head of, with all this stuff going on, you know, the underground in France and everything. They said the guy all the reports that came in, contrast them with, say, our last five presidents. So the dude every day read the equivalent of a Victorian novel. He read all this stuff and was capable of doing it. There were some people, and there probably are people today, I don't know if they ever get to the top, there were some people in World War II that had this incredible talent that you almost like, how can anybody even be like that? And yet they were. And pretty scary. I mean, he was in New York, talking about his story, and they were, before we were in the war, and there were German spies here that were letting people know in Germany when the convoys were leaving. So he was here visiting, and somebody said, yeah, we think this guy might be letting people know the convoys were here, and the guy goes, I don't worry about him anymore. the guy went out to pick up dinner, and while he was out for dinner, he'd nail this guy. So he said, we don't have to worry about him anymore. I mean, it was incredible what some of these people did. I mean, and the schedulers and the people who worked in these. Lou was over there. He was in what's the major bunker where they scheduled all the RAF during the Blitz and all the people that, how many people?
Churchill's, but yeah, I actually just toured. You told me to tour it, and I did.
Was it as fascinating as Lou said?
It was. Yeah, you told me to. My wife and I were over in London. I was doing some conference stuff, etc. And we did the we specifically did that tour because you told us to, and it was so cool.
You didn't go out there. Did you make it out to Bletchley Park?
I have still not made it to Bletchley Park, and I know you got a guy.
Yeah.
I hope your guy's still around at this point.
I hope he is, too, because he's like the grandson of... We should bring Larissa with. She loved this stuff. And so were her kids, for God's sake. Yeah. Bletchley Park was where they cracked the code. It was like the first computer ever, wasn't it, Russell?
Yeah. No, that's where they that's where they figured out the Enigma machine.
All right, so guys, get back a little bit on... We see the phenomenon here. We have a few minutes. What do you do with something like a Micron? And the thing that's weird about this... is this stock, when it got to like 100 back in 2001, led the crash down. I'm not predicting it. I'm saying I can't believe it's the same stock that's doing this, but it is. What
happened? I felt like it was Cisco last time, but there were a handful of them.
Yeah, there was a handful of them.
In fact, and the reason I've got Cisco in the mind is because I heard somebody asked about NVIDIA. Is it like a an internet stock? And I said, well, no, it's not like the internet stocks, but it's kind of like Cisco, and that's the one you want to keep an eye on. And I've brought that up a few times where I pay attention to who the big buyers are from NVIDIA, and when they report earnings, if they say anything about cutting capital spending, it's going to be horrible for NVIDIA. There's just no other way to put it.
How would you judge, I don't know if you guys saw the headline this week, with NVIDIA essentially conceding China to Huawei. I don't know what that means. I read some articles.
Fine, because Huawei's like a couple of generations behind. And when they say that that they've caught up to NVIDIA, that's complete crap. But Huawei, we won't allow Huawei in the United States just for security reasons. And but if you got, like, when I've traveled around Asia and stuff, you can buy a Huawei phone in Australia. You can buy a Huawei phone in pretty much anywhere in the Far East.
But where are they on these big chip things that NVIDIA's got?
They do make their own chips, much like Apple makes their own chips, but they are specific to telecommunications. The thing is, in order to really make the chips, you gotta build the machinery. It's not so much making the chip as it is building the facility and the machinery to make the chip, which we know is a long lead time. We've been talking about how we're bringing some of the chip production back to the United States, but it's not like flipping a switch. And it's not like flipping a switch over there as well. But I think they're just... saying that for whatever China's going to try to do in the AI arena, they're going to end up using Huawei chips instead of NVIDIA chips, but they're also going to be slower than us by using Huawei chips.
But weren't we supposed, our government, wasn't the idea that Trump was going to let NVIDIA sell this stuff to China with the government getting a 30% piece? And now they're not going to sell it.
Well, but what they were doing is they weren't selling the top end, the highest end stuff. They were basically gonna let them buy things that are in line with where Huawei is technology wise.
What you mind if I ask Larissa just a general question that I'll just say three instances in the last not that many years. When COVID happens, we go into some sort of a depression, sort of. I mean, we never counted it as what. And then we come out of it, and it would seem that when we came out of it, stock market obviously should rally when you come out of something that bad. Japan, oil prices, everybody supposedly gagging over there or whatever. You would think that if there is a deal in the Middle East and we go back to where we were or better, who knows, but the fact that everything opens up, you would think that Japanese stock market would rally. You would think our stock market would rally, but then you go, well, wait a minute. We're already higher than when we started in all three events. What does that tell you, other than me spouting off about money supply? When people say, like this morning, every day you hear it coming in, market's up based on hopes for a settlement in the Middle East. okay, except for the part that we never went down. We're up. I mean, what is it, logically, Larissa, what is it? What does that say to you? Or am I just being a goofball here?
Oh, I feel like it's a part of the greater fool theory, right? Remember, we've had many periods in the markets where we're so exuberant in grasping for anything that's a positive news story that we think that the prices are going to go higher, as opposed to there's been a shift in the fundamentals of the companies that we're looking at.
How much of you think is just, again, I try and summarize you guys a little bit every week with Hal kind of trickling along in his research on this stuff, and it's not just the money supply like old guys like me. It's the way the thing is set up now. A lot of it's Dodd-Frank, and Barney Frank just died. I don't even know he knew what he was doing with the thing, but it is so restrictive on who gets the money. And ever since I've been listening to him, I was mentioning it to John and Kevin earlier. In the last 2 days, let's say Micron is up, let's say $200. There's $1.1 billion shares outstanding. All right, so that's $220 billion worth of, quote, equity in accounts all across the country. I mean, we have some people here with Micron. Obviously, Merrill Lynch got quite a few more than we do. That is, if people wanted to, they could take that $220 billion from the last 2 days, not only spend that on other stocks, but borrow another $220 billion to buy even more stocks. And yet, and nobody would bat an eyelash tomorrow. We wouldn't. I mean, if somebody wanted to buy something, hey, this is your buying power, you can buy twice that, right? Duh. I mean, we don't have clients like that, so I guess if somebody did, it would be so rare here, we would bat an eyelash, but we wouldn't say no. Yet, what would it take? How many people, like the three of us, and we'll even include Andrew, what would it take for the three of us and all millions of people like us to go to the bank today and borrow $220 billion? It can't happen. So what Hal's saying is it doesn't filter through now to regular people. The only place that can get that loan are, what's the term, Russell, non-regulatory financial, whatever it is. Hal says almost all the increase in loans is in, like, margin loans and things like that. It's not in people getting the fourth plumbing truck and hiring three more plumbers. It's not in being able to go and easily buying a house for $200,000, saying, if you lend me $100,000 to remodel it, it's worth $4,000. Try and get that loan without turning over your wife and your kids and your house, for God's sake. You can't get it. And yet, in some areas, it's so easy. If Tesla wants to buy another company, forget the antitrust part, he can walk in tomorrow and get a loan without batting an eyelash. And Hal says it's the execution of this that is making all this worse. And every time he says that, we refer to your K-shaped recovery, Larissa. I think it ties in dramatically. Do you? Or am I just connecting what I shouldn't be connecting?
Well, I'd like to also go back to the, you know, we've got this additional wealth, and if you're looking particularly at the retail trader, I think the retail trader should be taking some money off the table. They should be collecting it, and I don't think that's happening because there's this over-exuberance. We're hoping that the market's going to continue to go up and that they're going to reap even more benefits from a rising stock price. And I think that's short-sighted, and I think that's something that's not explored enough. And it's this idea that there's more opportunities and we're so afraid of missing out on the next big stock market move, as opposed to being prudent and saying, okay, I've just made so much more money, now I need to take it off and deploy it somewhere else.
Larissa, I'll have you in as my next five clients. I'll have you in the room and I'll tell them you got all these numbers after your name. If you say that, you're going to get two questions. Man, you want me to pay taxes on this stuff?
Sure.
And or are you going to say, well, what am I going to do with it?
Right.
Those are the two questions. Okay, I sell my 1,000 shares of Micron, I get my $955,000. What am I going to do with it? You realize I got to pay taxes on it? That's what you get.
No, those are great questions. And I think those are important questions to be asking. But at the same time, if something fundamentally hasn't changed within the security of the stock, then you're in a situation where if you don't take money off the table, I think it's you're being foolish, because you might not be able to ever take the money off the table. So well, you're just holding. And again, this is based on the fundamentals and based on the idea that you do have other places that you would like to deploy it, and perhaps you need to diversify a little bit more. But my point is that so often we just hold winners without reaping any of the benefits, or selling off part of it or part of our winning that we never actually get to see it or get the materiality from that, our gains.
Well, you also, I mean, part of the situation, I'm going to read you guys something here in a minute if you'll let me, but part of the realization is the company is never going to reward you. I mean, if all of a sudden Micron, and we keep using that one because it was up so much, if they were going to make all that money, which, you know, that whoever's buying it seems to think they're going to, there was a time when you were to say, okay, don't worry about it. All of a sudden, I'm going to start getting checks of $5 a share every quarter that I'm going to participate through dividends. But nobody does that anymore. They pay like a 15-cent dividend. So it really is up to you to take your own profit. You're not going to get it out of them. But bear with me for a second here. When we're talking about, this is a liberal journalist, Gilbert Seldes. I call it panic to be afraid to sell at a profit, lest an additional profit be lost. The panic which keeps people at roulette tables, the insidious propaganda against quitting a winner, the fear of being taunted by those who held on, all worked together. It became not only a point of pride, but of civic duty not to sell, as if there were ever a buyer without a seller. That's the investigation of the crash of 29. Does it still ring true today, or what?
I think there's quite a bit of this, and it's, you know, this is Russell's area of expertise. This is all behavioral finance, how we behave when we're looking at securities and how we're looking at profits and how we're looking at how to move forward. I always quote, there's a academic study that demonstrates that women are better traders because they're better at letting go of losers and letting go of winners. They're able to cut ties much more easily with a trade than most men are.
I would, as having clients for how many years now, I'm going to say you are absolutely correct. God help you. And I have a lot of them, and a lot of them are my, especially guys that are self-made men, like a heart surgeon or somebody. They don't think they know just about heart surgery. They know about everything.
Sure.
And I got a real quick story about Micron. This is right before the crash started. We were doing lectures in Bahamas, of all places. That's how much people loved the market back then. They wanted to learn. So we went down. There was a seminar firm that did it. We weren't part of the firm, but I would give a lecture on what it's like trading the trading floor, and my brother would talk about selecting and how to put orders in and define the orders. I don't know, nobody cares about that stuff now, but in those days they did. And one of the stocks that was on a run, that's why this stock is so near and dear to me, was Micron. And it was trading like 95 or something. It would just run up. So I go, how many in the room own Micron? And I'm going to say two-thirds of the hands went up. And I go, okay, what's it going to take to roll over on a Monday morning and say to the wife, you know what, it's up high enough, I'm going to just sell some of it. It's just, it's kind of crazy, or I'd never buy it here. They go, oh no, why would we do that? It's just going higher. I said, I'll tell you what, how about it's trading 95, how about if I give you 120 for it right now? Five hands shut up, and they go, you know it's worth 150, you're trying to steal it from us.
Oh, geez.
That was the answer. And I think 6 months later, Russell, where was it, 6, 7? It got clobbered. But that's the mentality. I mean,
It took like 25 years for it to recover.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. Yeah.
The five or six stocks, help me here, Russell, the five or six stocks that were roughly 50% of the queues, like five are today, I think it was it Oracle, Cisco, Microsoft,
Intel, Microsoft.
What was the fifth?
Microsoft was one. Yeah. And
Oracle.
Was it Qualcomm?
Might have been.
I
don't know, but I know it was Dell, and then they took that private. Yeah. But Oracle and Cisco took years.
Qualcomm, yeah, Qualcomm. No, Qualcomm was like a behemoth back then.
Yeah.
But maybe it came with the cell phone thing because they were more.
Well, you know what? It was Intel.
Well, I said it. Yeah, okay. Intel, Cisco, Microsoft,
Oracle.
Oracle
and Dell,
and
Dell
was one of them. Yeah.
And Dell. Yeah. Those were the five, and I'm saying for 15 years, not one of them made it to their old highs.
No, it took over two decades for just the Nasdaq to recover.
Yeah, and you wonder, but then the taxes are an implication, and people don't want to pay taxes, I'll tell you what. The day I write $1 million check to the government, I'm taking you guys all out for the biggest steak there is, because that'd be what a great day that would be. I wouldn't have a problem with that, to be honest with you. Everybody else seems to have it, but wouldn't that be a good day?
That'd be a very good day. Well, it would have been a lot of good days leading up to that day.
Well, yeah. Well, so what you guys teach in summer school?
Derivatives.
That's right, you're doing the derivatives.
And Chicago-style finance.
What is that?
That is a two-day course in Chicago, Illinois, where we're visiting a handful of firms and we're visiting exchanges and learning why Chicago became the center of the derivatives world.
Are you going to show them the I&M Canal?
No.
That's why.
But I know that's why.
I know you do.
We're going to the Board of Trade. They're going to explain it there.
Okay.
Have you been to the Board of Trade Museum yet?
No, but I should go.
You should go. It's right next to your favorite place in the world.
I'm still pissed off that they closed the gallery.
They're reopening the gallery.
Do you know that
right now they've got the 8th floor closed over there right now, and SIBO's building a gallery.
But you know, the for those that don't know, for many, many years, the second most looked at tourist attraction in the city of Chicago after Buckingham Fountain was the Board of Trade Visitors Gallery.
Yeah, that's nice.
Did you know that?
I knew that. And it's just so nice.
Yeah.
It's one of those, it's such an iconic thing, and for those who enjoy the markets, it's such a rush to see it.
Yeah,
I believe it was one of those stimulus for a lot of traders when they came out and saw it and saw it actually happening and thought, I want to be a part of that. I need to be a part of that. So I think it's such an important thing to have that open so that people can see it, so that they can know that this is something that they need to need.
Russell, who's still left on the Board of Trade floor? The corn and wheat and all those guys' option pits are still there. The whatever the euro dollar calls now, they're still there. There's some open outcry, right?
Yeah, for options, there's CME does have some. Yeah.
What do they call the euro dollar now?
SOFR, Secured Overnight Financing Rate. And when they transferred that contract over, it did not skip a beat.
Well, there used to be like 400 people in that pit. How many are there now?
Oh, there were more than 400.
They're more old away.
No, I was in that pit at one time. It was well over. It was massive. So, but I have no idea how many people are in that pit. I haven't been to a Merck floor since COVID. I used to have to go over there and do some media stuff every once in a while. I don't really know what it's looking like these days.
Well, Santelli's, he's over on the option floor now, right?
Yeah, he's at SIBO. SIBO's got a very strong relationship with CNBC now.
Well, good for them. I mean, I think he does a good job, I think.
Oh, I think he does an awesome job.
Yeah.
There's a gentleman named Oliver Rennick who I've worked with off and on for years, that's like an option reporter now for CNBC, and he does great work.
Well, good. I mean, I'll be happy to see you. Listen, I'm glad you enjoyed your weekend, and everybody, be good till next week. And let's Let's make some money, eh? What do you think?
Let's make a lot of money.
Got no kidding. SP futures up 10.
My short China position is up 6% overnight, so good. We're making a lot of money.
Well, hey, what? Last question. What? Where is gold and silver fitting all this? We still have big positions in there. And
I think gold and silver is being artificially moved around by central banks, trying to gear up for the best, for their best situation, based on conflict.
Okay, but
China's been dumping our bonds forever, and they've been replacing it with gold. And there was a European country that's Turkey just got out of all of our debt, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if some of that money went into gold, because it's a good store of value.
What are we going to do if these guys keep cutting back on how much they invest over here?
We'll eventually bite the bullet and have to offer higher interest rates.
Yep. We can run over a minute because we started a minute late, but actually we are over a couple minutes. But next week maybe we'll kick this up. There's a lady who does these economic things on YouTube now, and she's not as bright as Larissa, but she was talking, Larissa, about the implied deal that the U.S. has had for like a real long time, where we buy more goods because we need them from other places, and they turn around and finance essentially our excess spending by buying bonds here, which the Trump administration is trying essentially to break that cycle. Now, because I don't think, I'll take a shot, I guess. I don't think Trump knows the difference between a trade deficit and a current account deficit, but whether he does or he doesn't. But the point is this lady said, if we break that, we don't realize what the repercussions are. Because if all of a sudden we have to pony up the money here for 40% of our government bonds, what is that going to do to interest rates? If we say we don't want your stinking money because we don't want to buy your stuff anymore, she said it's not something that maybe is the best thing that anybody ever could devise, but it's been there for 45 years, and you to not understand it and just kind of try and break it is really dangerous. I mean, you may have a better way of doing it, but to just say this, we don't want this anymore without figuring out what the solution is going to be, is dangerous. What do you think of that?
I have never been a fan of the currency wars. This has been a problem for decades. I don't like that China artificially manipulates its currency price to keep prices down. I think that makes it much more difficult for Americans to compete from a manufacturing standpoint. I also don't like cheap goods, so I might be an anomaly there. I would rather us move away from purchasing the cheaper goods from China, and for us to create our own goods that are higher quality that will last longer.
Well, I'm with you now. What do you say we tee that up kind of a lot next week? Because it's this whole there's a circle to this, that if you can't just break one part, right?
Correct.
And let's try and understand that a little more next week, and you guys can educate me. SP Futures not only up 8. We're still up. Nasdaq futures still up 130. We were up a lot more than that. We'll see what happens today. Guys, have a good weekend. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.